The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
How are you, sir?
This is Pierre.
Oh.
I can't believe I'm talking to you, Dr. Ray the Great.
Well, I don't know about that.
I love listening to you. You have a personality just like my father.
I don't think you should feel helpless. You are helpless.
Doctor, I really appreciate that. That makes me feel a lot better.
You be at peace, or else I'm going to yell at you.
Trying to find a reason to speak to you. I think you're the best thing since sliced bread.
That Ray, he's something.
Thank you so much for what you're doing for all the parents out there.
I don't know what I can possibly do.
I don't either.
I'm getting my money worth, I think, at this phone call.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
How can you get your money's worth if you're not paying anything? I mean, it's not even I'm giving her my 2 cents. I'm getting my money's worth. What did you pay for this? Nothing. So that was your money's worth. I don't think she realized that was an insult. You know, when you talk to a shrink, you can't assume we're just going to hear what you said. We're going to hear what you didn't say. Shrinks do that. I'm hearing what you're not saying. This is Dr. Ray. Thanks for joining me here on The Doctor Is In. This is Look Back Friday. I've been doing this for a couple, 3 years now, unless sometimes we do a live show, but most of the time we take previous calls, edited at the capable, adept hands of Andrew Krucek, producer man, father of John and Audra Rose. Rose is making a comeback as a name. My little granddaughter's name is Rose. Rose is a big name by any other name. So he takes the calls, he edits them as he sees fit. He edits me out of a lot of the calls. He does. I don't know why he does this. He said I got rid of the dead weight in the call. Then I, right now on Look Back Friday, I get to speak more about the call. Why do I do this? Well, sometimes there's more I want to say, and I can't say it because it's in a 4 or 5 minute radio call. You have to go in the direction generally that the caller goes in, but not always. There's times when I veer off, and the caller's thinking, "What is he doing with this? Where is he going with this?" And they hang up. Perplexed. So we'll be getting to your calls momentarily. I want to talk about this because this has been a passion of my life for, ever so many years. I have been told by probably, 8, 9 doctors not to do it anymore, to quit it. And, of course, I didn't listen to them at all. And I'm glad that I didn't because, in fact, it didn't bring about what they had predicted, and I think I've gained from it. Now, what is all this? When I was 18 years old, I was a freshman. I was rushed by a fraternity on Case Western Reserve's campus, Phi Delta Theta. The Phi Deltas were the jocks. They were the lifters. They were the heavy dudes, and they rushed me. So one of them said, hey, why don't you come with me? I'm going down to the gym. I'm going to work out. Oh, okay, I've never worked out. I never did any of that. So I went down, and he put the bar. It was, I think it was 125 on the bar, 125 pounds. At that time, I think I was 155. He said, see what you can do with it. And I think I did 8 times. And that was it. I was hooked, absolutely hooked. When you're young and you lift, You've got it in you because you make gains about every 3 times that you go in there and lift. And so ever since, I've been lifting weights. Never really stopped other than an injury. And even with an injury, I didn't lift with the injured part. Now, the part about the doctors. Several times they told me, look, you've got nerve impingement here, or you've got this particular bony prominence, and this will happen and that'll happen. And I said, well, okay, well, we'll see. I'll monitor it. And it never happened. And so I still lift to this day. Much research is coming out. I'm speaking now to the women, particularly. Much research is just coming out everywhere that says strength training is incredibly healthy for you. Incredibly healthy. Every once in a while, we'll run up against someone in the weight room that's female and says, oh, I just don't want to get bulky. And we say, well, you're not going to get bulky. You don't have the testosterone. You don't have the hormones to get bulky. What you're going to do is you're going to build strength. That's what you want. Typically, women who come in for the first time and they're, say, 35, 40, 45 years of age are shocked. They are absolutely shocked at their low level of upper body strength. Very low. They're surprised at this because they know that, for example, if they reach across the back seat to pick up an 8-pound, 1-gallon jug of milk, it's hard. They can't lift it out at the end of their arm. They can't do that. Or getting out of a car. They get out of a car, they have to kind of grab something to pull themselves up because their legs at that angle don't give them enough strength to get out of the car. And they're ever so pleased after a month or maybe a month and a half of lifting, they've doubled their strength. That's the one thing about lifting weights. When you're walking into, and you don't have to, it doesn't have to be a gym. It doesn't have to be a place where you got the orcs and the Uruk-hai, you know, from, what was that, Lord of the Rings? Yeah, the guy, no, you don't have to be that. There's machines there that's safe. You go in and you will make dramatic gains the first month or two. They've done studies with people in nursing homes in their 80s, and they put them on a weight training program. And within a matter of 8 to 12 weeks, they've doubled their strength in their 80s. So, highly recommended. Now, people will say, I don't have time. I just don't have the time to do that. I can't get in there 3 or 4 days a week. 2 days a week is enough. You will make gains on 2 days a week. You will probably even make gains on 1 day a week. The problem with that is you'll get sore. You can't just go in there 1 day a week and the soreness will ultimately go away. It will go away with 2 days a week. So the first day or two after you first go in and you start, you're going to be sore. You're going to be sore places where you used it and you're thinking, oh, that hurts. Don't even touch me there. It hurts so bad. It'll go away. That will go away. Well, I don't even know. How many sets do I do? You could do one. There's research that says, basically, you get your maximum gain in that first set to exhaustion. Now, unless you're a bodybuilder or a power lifter, you're going to get your main gain, 90-plus percent of your gain, first set to exhaustion. Probably about 10, 12 years ago, my brother and I, who've been lifting together for 30-some years, we decided to go to one set. Pretty much everything except a couple of exercises. We gained. We didn't lose anything with one set. As long as you go to fatigue, that's the key. Well, how many? That varies, whatever you're comfortable with. Most people hover in the, 8 to 15 range. You can do 20, you can do 30 reps. That's okay. There's research that says high reps will build muscle tissue just as well. The only reason you lose the lower reps is to try to build strength and to handle a heavier weight. But if you're not in there for heavy lifting, don't worry about handling a heavy weight because you could hurt yourself. So, one set, twice a week, and pretty much every body part. You get the young kids coming in, I'm working on buys and tries today. Meaning biceps and triceps. I'm going to do back tomorrow, and then I got legs on Thursday. Yeah, okay, they're 22 years old. They got the inclination. They got the motivation. They got the time to do that. I don't do that anymore. I mean, I used to when I lifted heavy. I used to. But now, you know, when I lifted early in my life, I felt like I was lifting on the moon. You know, the gravitational pull of the moon is about 1/6 that of the Earth. So I felt like I was lifting on the moon. Now I feel like I'm lifting on Jupiter. I've noticed this. Okay, I'm thinking, you know, the gravitational pull of the Earth is getting heavier. I've been noticing that. I'm getting taller, though. I really am getting taller because it's a lot harder to bend all the way down to the ground. So I must be getting taller. So, women, I cannot tell you what a benefit it will be. The day-to-day activities, going up steps, carrying something in the house, holding on to a kid, putting him in bed, you will make terrific gains. We usually tell the ladies who come in that if they stick with it for 6 months, they will be 3 times their strength. They don't believe that, but it's true. It is true. Now, of course, you're going to asymptote out, which basically means they're going to come to be a point where your gains are going to become fewer and farther between because you're pushing to the level of your body structure. And unless you gain weight, weight is strength, unless you gain weight, you're going to pretty much... You know, I've been at the same weights for probably 10, 15 years. I haven't gone up. The only time I ever go up is if I change an exercise. If I do something that I haven't done for a while, then you get used to the exercise and you go up with that particular exercise. They've done research that says the average person starts losing muscle tissue in the 30s. And you lose about 1% of your muscle per year. So by the time you're 55, you've lost 20% of your muscle tissue. If you don't do anything. If you do, and you look at the graph, in fact, your muscle strength lingers. It lingers well into your 50s, and you don't lose much. I remember the last time I bench pressed was 310. The last time I did that, I was in my 50s. Okay, now I haven't done it since because bench is kind of a tough exercise for your shoulders. But we do dumbbell bench presses now. We use the dumbbells on the bench press, and you can control them a little bit more. I'm not as heavy as I once was. You start to lose weight as you get older. There's no way around that. It just happens. Contrary to people thinking, you gain weight as you get older. Yeah, you gain weight, but it's fat weight. You lose muscle weight as you get older. That's what happens. All right, that is the natural progression. But I wanted to talk about this because I wanted to give the ladies some encouragement. And the other thing that happens, believe it or not, your mood. It improves your mood. It truly does. Because you feel like I'm actually making my body do something it was designed to do. We're a very sedentary society. We don't do much at all. We no longer have to cut down trees with an axe. We no longer have to get behind a plow. We no longer work manual labor anywhere near the degree we used to. So now, what do? Well, people say, I don't know, I'm trudging up the stairs. You know, they've done an interesting study. What they found was that people who are overweight estimate that they burn more calories per day than they actually do. And the reason is because it's more effort. You're going up those steps, and if you're carrying 50, 60, 70 extra pounds, you're carrying 50, 70 extra pounds up those steps. And when you get to the top of the steps, you're thinking, wow, I burned a lot of calories. Well, you exerted. There's no question about that. You exerted. So this has just been a passion of mine. It's been something I hope the good Lord allows me to do until the day I leave this earth. At this point in my age, I'm trying to hold off the decline is what you're doing. You're not going to make too many more gains anymore, but you're holding off the decline. So when we come back, we got a call. Let me see over here on my board from Ashley, who had some problems with her former employer who was a nonprofit. So we'll find out what that's about, and then I'll talk some more about it. Thanks for joining me.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
60 Seconds with Father Mitch Pacwa.
The state has responsibility to orient things, but they can't take over the rights of the family, like in China, to have one child and that's it. It's a disaster over there. How many tens of millions of abortions have gone on? And one of the things that, as a result of that, is because of the preference to have boy children rather than girls, you have, for every 1,000 boys, there are 850 girls. This is a great imbalance. Same thing is going on in northern India. So this is where the government cannot take away the primary and inalienable responsibility of married couples and families. And they cannot employ methods which fail to respect the person and fundamental human rights. Beginning with the right to life, the government cannot force you to kill innocent human beings and still be a humanistic government. It's an evil government.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ray. My latest book, Jesus, the Master Psychologist, Listen to Him, talks about how Jesus was 2,000 years ahead of modern enlightened psychology. If he's God, he knows the absolute best way to live, whether psychology agrees or whether it doesn't. Go to AveMariaRadio.net to get your copy. Jesus will tell you the best way to live.
You know, that kind of music intimidates me. There are two reasons. Remember when you were younger and you looked out on the dance floor at a wedding reception and you saw somebody out there that was 45 years old and you were 23 because your friend's getting married in their 20s and you thought to yourself, what's that old person doing out there? He's going to hurt himself. Well, I had that revelation some time back. I went out there and I was dancing. My wife, she had enough sense not to go out there. And I came back and she said, you know, Ray, you're the old person that's out there. And people were saying, that guy's going to hurt himself. What's he doing out there? But I always looked at these people like that music, that Latin kind of music. You always have a couple in their 60s or 70s that can dance like that. And you think, how do they do that? When I dance, I look like a frog in a blender. I do. It's not really pretty. Let's go to Ashley from Indiana, see what she's got to say.
I'm calling. I used to work for a not-for-profit organization where I was a resident about 12 years ago. And I...
Wait, Ashley, when you say resident, what do you mean?
Okay, so the non-for-profit organization was a maternity home for pregnant women, and it still is. So I was pregnant and homeless about 12 years ago, and found God there and realized I need to be Catholic, having met a volunteer and that kind of thing. And it's been in my heart give back to this organization. I've done speaking events. I've volunteered throughout the past 12 years. But then I was offered a position there, and I took the position. But the executive director that I was working underneath was bullying me, harassing me, I believe not paying me what I was supposed to be being paid so that she doesn't have to pay overtime. And I ended up resigning after a really big incident, and I had won my original unemployment case, but right now they're appealing it, and I want so badly to fight it, not because of the amount of money that I'm going to get back. I'm only going to get like $37 back once the $300 additional that was supposed to be getting goes away, and so it's not worth it, you know, but what is worth it to me is that the residents in the home currently are all very young, and we tell them, you know, we're a Christian organization, you're part of our family, we love you, but yet you have the executive director bullying them, trying to manipulate them, control them. And so, you know,
does the staff agree with you, Susan? Does the staff say, yeah, we all see that?
They've seen it, but they've decided just to leave. And I have text messages and messages on Facebook from the former employees that I worked with. And I've reached out to them asking if they would kind of stand up for me and say, yeah, this was my experience. I experienced the same thing. And they've all said that they don't feel comfortable with it, or they've pretty much just kind of washed their hands of it and walked away. And I don't know what to do. I've tried to find a lawyer to give me some legal advice, but I keep getting closed doors, like no one's calling me back. And I've prayed about it. I've asked God, what should I do? And I just get silent.
How long ago did you work for them?
I left just this past March.
Okay. And I can't give you any direction because, one, I have no idea what the specifics are. I don't know. Someone might say, well, no, we didn't bully Susan. Susan is fragile, and Susan took things we did as bullying, and we tried to direct her, and she got mad. I don't know, okay? But if I take you straight at your word, if in fact this director was hard to work for, power-hungry, imperious, you have to decide what will you gain, what will happen if you bring some kind of charges, and again, based upon what? That she was not a nice person. How would you do that? What would you say? She bullied me, and then they're going to say, "How'd she bully you?" Well, she said this. Well, okay. And she says, "No, I didn't." Do you have any proof of that? No. You see what I'm saying? I mean,
you have.
I'm not a lawyer.
He said, she said. But
yeah, I'm not a lawyer, but you really have to have some kind of concrete evidence that some inappropriate things really happened. Not just the fact that I think she was nasty to me. I don't think she gave me credit. I think she cheated me out of $37. Whatever that is, you may find, Susan, it'll destroy your peace going after this, as opposed to just simply saying, I will pray that if, in fact, this woman is hurting this nonprofit, I will pray that that will be discovered. I will pray that some of the young girls who are there will go to somebody higher up, will go to the funding sources, whatever, that they will do it. It's interesting that you couldn't get anybody else who had left that agency to say, absolutely, I had the same experience. Yes, we got to do something about it. You couldn't get anybody to do that, which is, again, going to hurt your cause if you have one, because they're all saying, no, it wasn't that bad. We just didn't like her.
Yeah, they're just saying they feel uncomfortable about doing it. And I think it's because they're afraid that she may, ruin their credibility for getting another job or that kind of thing. I've went to the board as well, and I've tried to share with them text messages, emails, that type of thing.
Okay.
But did
you get anywhere?
I didn't get anywhere at
right.
all. No.
So I think that's your answer. I think that the board has said, we've looked at what you've said. We don't find any confirming evidence of this. And perhaps they're likely to look at you as a disgruntled former employee. And if you don't have them looking at this, you're really tentative in your ability to do anything about it. So I my advice to you just would be to consider strongly looking for your own peace, moving on and saying it was an ugly experience, but I really don't have any reason that as I see it to sue this woman. We don't like it when people behave badly as we see it. There's something in us that says they shouldn't do that. Now, and raise an interesting point, because as Christians, we have a moral plumb line. But if you're not a Christian, and even if you don't believe in God, you don't really have a moral plumb line. What you have is a preference plumb line. She's wrong. Well, how do you know she's wrong? Because she shouldn't do that. Says who? Well, says me. Well, that's just you. Well, but that she mistreated people. Okay, so she mistreated them. How's that wrong? There's no God. So, in fact, all you can say is, I don't like what she did. You can't say it's wrong, because why? Well, she's got the power. She did it. Well, she shouldn't have done it. See, whenever you say shouldn't without God, all you're simply saying is, I don't agree with it. I don't like it. I don't want it to be that way. See, what's happening here with Susan is that she's frustrated because she has a certain protective sense for those young girls. She's saying, I know what this woman was like with me, or at least she sensed what this woman was like with her, and she worries about the young girl. She says, we're supposed to act right. And all that may be true. Let's just take it that is the way it is. It comes down to the woman acted in ways that Susan found very, very disconcerting. The board people, for whatever the reason, either didn't believe Susan, or in fact, they said, we believe her, but we like this lady. She's a good administrator. All right, so we put up with her personality flaws because she's successful with this agency. I don't know what the board's motivation is. Maybe she's even gotten something on the board members, or maybe somehow she's involved with the board members' appointments. I don't know. But the bottom line is, this is a situation that, for Susan's own peace, she's got to let go. She's got to more or less simply say, I've traveled avenues, and now I'm going to just lay it to rest and recognize that people who claim to be Christians can act in a very unchristian way.
Who may officiate at a wedding ceremony in the Catholic Church? According to the Catechism, in the Latin tradition, a priest or a deacon are the Church's authorized ministers who preside over the ceremony and receive the consent of the two spouses in the name of the Church and give them the blessing of the Church. It is the presence of the ministers as well as the spouses which visibly expresses the fact that the marriage is an ecclesial reality. The Church normally requires that the faithful contract marriage according to the ecclesiastical form because sacramental marriage is a liturgical act, so it ought to be celebrated in the public liturgy of the Church. Marriage is a state of life in the Church, so certainty about it is a necessity. Preparation for marriage is of prime importance, says the Catechism, citing the example and teaching of parents and families as a special form of this preparation. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Father Benedict Groeschel.
I often go back to my childhood. In church, we love to be reverent, to Christ present in the Eucharist, to Christ on the cross. But I was also impressed by the reverence of my friends in the Salvation Army. They had a little band, and I used to walk past the band on Sunday morning on my way to church. And I was just a child, but I said, you know, they're trying to pray to God. They're showing reverence to God. All this was reverence. Now what do I see? I hear one irreverence after another. And week after week, month after month, the media churns out things that make fun of religion in general and make fun of Christianity in particular, and particularly make fun of the Catholic Church. No class. Absolutely no class.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
You got to understand how hard it is to do this program with two guys in this studio that are doing some sort of, I don't know what that dance is with the hands where you go like that. It's kind of a sort of a reverse wave or something. I have no idea what it is. Anyway, good to have you with us. The Doctor is in Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. Co-production. Hate when I do that. It's like you're looking for words to find. There's all these, they call them crutch words. Yeah, you know, I mean, like, well, listen to someone that is a politician talking. Politicians are notorious for this. They use and constantly. Why? Because they're just so carefully selecting their words. And they have to recognize what is the most appropriate action in these circumstances. Drives me crazy. All right. So this is Look Back Friday, co-production of the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network and Ave Maria Radio Communications. We take some previous calls, and I don't want to say reanalyze them. I'd like to say overanalyze them. I do that. I'm a psychologist. I always overanalyze stuff. You got to know when to stop. This is from Aaron from New York. This is regarding an adopted granddaughter.
How did you come about getting custody of your granddaughter?
Well, the state of California decided that our daughter was not fit to raise her child. So that was about 3 years ago because of neglect or abuse. And, of course, it wasn't her fault, but no one can figure out whose fault it was. So we've had our granddaughter for about 3 years. The adoption just went through in March. And originally we had adopted her mother at 5 years old because of the same thing. And now we've adopted the granddaughter, and, you know, it's just pretty, complicated.
How old was the granddaughter when she came to live with you, Aaron?
She was just a little over one.
Okay. Did at the time that your daughter was declared unfit, were there drugs and alcohol involved?
Oh, yeah. There was, she was in rehab when she got pregnant. She was clean for a while, and then after the baby was born, She was headed back that way again.
Do you know if she was clean during her pregnancy?
Yes. Yes.
You know that for sure? You can. That's a definite?
Yeah, she was. She was in a facility, a mother, unwed mother's facility that they did testing all the time.
Okay. All right. That's good. That's really good. That's really, really good, Aaron. Yeah. And the reason that's really, really good is because I know you're asking for what book I have that would help you, and I will suggest one. But I think even more important is the fact that in the womb, your little granddaughter was not bathed in toxins. The damage that that does to the little developing brain is almost incalculable. She is now, what, four?
She's four.
Four. Is she a behavior problem?
No, not really. She's a lovely little girl, very loving.
Wonderful.
This is honestly, when we look at her, we're thinking, this is the little girl we thought we were adopting the first time.
Well, and, adopting her at five, especially with a turbulent history, you saw how that unfolded.
Yeah, sure did.
Well, I have a book that is by far my most popular parenting book. It's called Discipline That Lasts a Lifetime. It's been a big seller for years now. It is 100 of the most common discipline questions I get asked, ages 2 to 18. So I would say probably about 30 or 40 of those questions right now are most relevant to you and where your little granddaughter is developmentally.
Okay. All right.
But as she grows up, more and more questions become relevant. It's on my website, drray.com. There's also a book on adoption there. There's also a book on grandparenting there. But I think the one that would actually aim closest to saying, okay, look, we got a beautiful little granddaughter here. We want to keep it that way.
Right.
That would be the one. Now, if you're only going to buy one. Now, of course, I'm going to tell you, Aaron, if you only buy one, you're going to have psychological holes. You are. There's no way around it. And you're going to call me 3 years from now. You're going to say,
I already have psychological
holes. Don't say I didn't warn you. Appreciate it, my friend. God bless you.
Yeah.
Okay,
I'll talk to you.
Bye.
Did you hear what Aaron said when he said, this time around, and that wasn't his exact words, mine, this time around in the adoption of his little granddaughter was what they thought they were going to experience in the adoption of their daughter. And did you hear me jump in and say, yeah, but she was five? Probably about 25 or 30 years ago, when I had just gotten out of middle school. Oh, wait a minute, I got to back off here. My nose is pushing against this microphone as it's growing. I was seeing a disproportionate number of adoptive parents coming into my office. At the time, the main theories because of this, these were kids who were struggling to grow up. They were making bad judgments. They were impulsive. Maybe they're learning problems, immaturity, maybe slow conscience formation. The dominant theories were abandonment, reactive attachment disorder, sense of identity struggles. In other words, they were psychological. I remember thinking, this seems to be deeper than psychological. This seems to be somewhere involved in the wiring of the brain. And since then, there's a lot of research has come out that said that womb environment and those very early years, if they're erratic and if they're turbulent and if they're drug-soaked and alcohol-soaked, does damage to the brain. Now, that's not to say you can't raise a child like this, but it says a higher proportion of them can be difficult to raise and may not do well as young adults or even adults. I have some adopted children like that, and the ones that we adopted older have struggled more, and they also had the more turbulent womb histories. So given that, I think what Aaron's experiencing, and he didn't say this, but when he adopted his little daughter at age five, she already had a major history, and that history probably included her birth mom's drug and alcohol abuse.
because of that, she was probably a struggle to raise. And as he implied, as she got older, she made bad judgments. She made bad decisions. And you can see that. She's been into drugs and alcohol. She was in rehab. She had her child taken from her by the authorities. So that indicates that she herself was not navigating life well. So now Aaron is in a position to say, all right, we've got her little daughter. But the best news of that whole thing, and you heard that in my voice, is that little daughter, as far as Aaron can tell, had a clean womb. That's huge. That is big. Now, I don't know what the history was that first year, what kind of neglect there might have been before the daughter was taken. But it's good news for Aaron and his wife.
Hello and welcome to The Crux of the Matter. I'm Father Wade Menezes. If there's one doctrinal teaching of the Catholic Church that stands out particularly strong in this modern day and age, a teaching that everybody seems to know, both Catholics and non-Catholics alike, whether they agree with it or not, it's the teaching that priestly ordination is reserved to men alone. But this time-honored doctrine, held by the Church since the time of Christ and his apostles, in no way militates against the dignity of women, their natural gifts or vocation, nor is the fact that women are ineligible to receive the sacrament of holy orders to be viewed as a reflection against their universal call to holiness, to which all persons are called. In modern times, the Church has repeatedly and definitively reiterated the reasons why the sacrament of holy orders can be received only by men. Pope John Paul II, in his apostolic letter on reserving priestly ordination to men alone, quotes Pope Paul VI in stating some of these reasons, including the example recorded in the sacred scriptures of Christ choosing his apostles only from among men, the constant practice of the Church, which has imitated Christ in choosing only men, and her living teaching authority, which has consistently held that the exclusion of women from the priesthood is in accordance with God's plan for his Church. In actual fact, then, the Church concludes that she is not authorized to admit women to priestly ordination. In other words, the Church herself cannot change this teaching. She has not the authority to do so. And this is because the Church recognizes herself to be bound, as it were, by this choice made by the Lord himself. A choice, mind you, which he made freely, since he shows himself time and time again in the Gospels to not have been subject to the prevailing customs or social conditions of his time. This has been The Crux of the Matter, and I'm Father Wade Menezes. God bless you.
Dispensing a potent drug for psychological well-being, Doc is in. Now, that drug went off patent after probably about 16 years on the air, so that drug went off patent. But you can still get it. You can get the generic version, tri-psychanol. Okay, that is the generic version. You get it interaurally, not orally, aurally, A-U-R-A-L-L-Y, through the ear. All right, you can get it. There's no overdose potential. You can get as much of it as you want. No one has yet had side effects from it. So that's just something to indicate. I'm Dr. Ray Guarendi. This is The Doctor Is In. This is the Friday version. This is Look Back Friday. It's not really a look back. It's a listen back. But look back sounds so much better in the appellation of the name. This is something that has had quite a history. It's up and down and up and down. For a while, it was the answer to serious mental disorders. And then it fell out of favor. But now it's made a bit of a resurgence as one option for intervention-resistant, biochemically-based, you love a nice fling around those psychologically-sounding words, depression. So we got a call from Steve, who's curious because he has a friend who one of the doctors or mental health people or whomever his friend is seeing recommended shock therapy, which is otherwise known as, I'll think of it after the call.
You know a girl with extreme anxiety, huh?
Yes, I do. And make a long story short, she's suffered it from quite a few years.
mainly because when she was mother's boyfriend did some unpleasant things to her. So she has a lot of anxiety. She's had a lot of different medicines to try to alleviate that. Now her psychologist says that he wants to try shock therapy on her. I'm just wondering if that will help, do you think?
Okay, let's look at this. Is there depression along with the anxiety?
I believe so, yes.
All right.
She's in a day treatment program, and part of that, she's been in there for a couple of weeks now, and she's been hospitalized a number of times this year, and I've kind of taken her under my wing, family has, to make sure she gets the PHP and stuff, because parental thing wasn't doing well with her.
So, how old is she, Steve?
19.
Okay.
She has a history of cutting.
Okay. I am certainly not going to say anything that would add, subtract, or contradict, or confirm what her therapist is saying. That's just not my place. What I can do is give you some explanation as possibly why he said this.
Okay.
I asked you if she's had a history of depression. You said yes.
Yes.
I asked you, you clearly confirmed that she's been hospitalized a number of times, so that would indicate treatment-resistant depression, not responding to the medications.
Correct.
It is not unusual for shock therapy, electroconvulsive therapy, to be an intervention for someone who has had treatment-resistant depression. So that would probably explain why the psychologist has said we ought to consider this, because everything else we've tried, the course you're on, has not improved.
Mm-hmm.
And in the old days, do you remember the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Yes.
Did you ever see it? Okay. And it surely presented electroconvulsive therapy as this barbaric, kind of awful sort of treatment. Well, it's been improved dramatically since. The body doesn't go into these grand mal seizures. They give a drug that more or less paralyzes the body, and the fingers twitch or the thumb will twitch. That's all that happens. And there is research that indicates that electroconvulsive therapy in some good selected cases is like a miracle. Okay? So that'd be my guess as to why the psychologist has said, let's look into this. It works best for what is probably considered or diagnosed as a biochemically based depression. Now, people will say, well, how do you know? How do you know it's biochemically based? Well, we don't have any tests for that. You can't really do it. You do it on the basis of symptomatology. If you've ever seen somebody that's seriously depressed, they're almost catatonic. They're almost to the point where they don't look even reasonably normal. Now, people can get themselves seriously depressed by the way they think, by the way that they retreat from life, by the way, for example, that some trauma or tragedy has occurred to them, and it lingers, and it is fueled by the way they interpret it. That's true. I mean, I've seen folks who are probably not biochemically depressed, but I'll tell you, they are almost paralyzed with their emotions. Electroconvulsive therapy will work best for someone that indeed is clearly unresponsive to other stuff. Now, why does it work? I'm not sure we truly understand that. What seems to happen is that it essentially activates the brain, the cerebral cortex part of the brain, where our thinking and our judgment and all of our executive functions are located. And it just gives them a shot, a jolt, that seems to rev up the engine. Now, how long it lasts has always been the debate. And there are times when you can get more than one ECT treatment. As I mentioned, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest basically portrayed it as something that would make someone almost an unresponsive individual that would take away their personality. Remember the big Native American there? I forget what his name was, but he in essence had been subjected to ECT, and they made him seem like a zombie, or even Jack. What was his name? Jack? Who's the guy that starred in that? Nicholson. Yeah, Jack Nicholson. And these guys were both malingering. Now, you know what malingering is? Malingering is you're faking your symptoms, okay, or you're letting them linger. And both of them were playing a role that made it look like the shock therapy had just turned them into zombies, when in fact they were playing the system. However, the image is created that this can supposedly do that to people, and not really. It's much more sophisticated now to use it. So I would guess that's probably why the psychologist said, well, let's go this route. The other problem, and as the caller was describing it, is this woman has a wide range of life problems. Anxiety, probably struggles in her adolescence and teen years. She's only 19. Cutting. So the symptom picture is not just depression. It's probably a multi-diagnosis kind of symptom picture with a big mishmash of all kinds of emotional, thinking, behavioral, social problems all mixed together. That would probably make the ECT a little less effective, but we'd have to see on that. You'd have to see how it goes. All right. So I'm Dr. Ray. Last break.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
The Archbishop of Detroit, Alan Vigneron, published a little booklet called The Beauty of Truth, and it deals with this very question of words and the use of words. And it's a great sorrow, the Archbishop points out, when the quantity of words being expressed is at an all-time high, and the consequences of ill-used words are causing more harm to the cause of truth and the good of the human soul than maybe ever before. Are we part of the problem, or are we part of the solution? Are we constantly carping about society, church, media, police? Because if so, we're gonna have to go out of our way to demonstrate this kind of patience with one another, to let people think through things rather than, you know, immediately slam them with, I've got the answer for you, buddy. Words matter.
Cresta in the Afternoon, weekdays at 4 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Okay, I've been a Catholic for 5 years, but I suffered under a lot of things due to my Protestantism as a Pentecostal, and I just want to personally ask God to bless you for your ministry, for everything you do, and the help that you give people.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
Guys in this studio playing air guitar. You can be really good on air guitar, you know. You sound exactly like the dudes that are doing it. Have you ever noticed guys play air guitar, women don't? I've never seen a woman play an air guitar, but guys will. Seen a woman play a harp, an air harp once. You don't see that very often, or an air harmonica. Good to have you with me. I'm Dr. Ray. The last segment, let us find out why Elise is so sensitive to what she labels criticism. Now, why do you think you get so shook up if somebody criticizes you?
I'm really not sure what it is. I just noticed that at work, especially because I have one boss in particular that he has this harsh way of speaking sometimes. And I don't know if it's because my parents were, we just are a family that doesn't raise our voices much. So I find even just a tone of voice can just get my heart racing. But, I mean, and then he'll criticize something about my work. And I'll just find it's like a physiological reaction that I just start tearing up. And I don't want to, because in my mind I'm thinking I need to be open to criticism so I can use it constructively. I'm just wondering if there's anything I can be thinking or doing differently so that it doesn't, like, make me just want to crawl in a corner, you know? Because I recognize that this is not something I want for myself. So when you were doing that opening monologue about about just stop it, it kind of resonated.
You are accurate, Elise, when you say my body reacts. It's reflex. If I hear something that sounds harsh or put downish, my heart just goes. It's not even a matter of, okay, well, I don't like that. It's my body says, danger, 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 look out, look out, look out, get ready. That's what your body does.
Yeah.
How old are you, Elise?
I'm 27.
Okay, so you're a young girl, and that's good, because what we got to do is rewire your body. Now, that's going to take a while. That is going to take a while.
Mm-hmm.
I play softball. And long, long, long since, I've stopped getting upset on the field. Back when I was younger and you were more intense, if there was a bad call or somebody blew something or somebody wasn't hustled, you had to really control yourself not to get upset. Mm-hmm. Well, last night we were playing something and I pitched before my outfield was ready. I just didn't turn around and look. They weren't ready. They were still getting adjusted. And about three or four guys said something, you know, let us get ready, you know, that kind of thing. And you know what I did? I took my glove and I threw it at the ground. I just threw it. Now, why would I do that? And I know exactly why I did it. Because I still have a little bit of residual wiring in me from all those days as a heavy competitor, where softball meant so much, you know, whether you won, whether you lost when you're 23 years old. Okay? So I think something similar happens with you. For whatever the reason in your history, when people would say things about you that you didn't want to hear, you thought they were unfair,
yeah,
they were being mean, you cringed. And you got on a roll of this stuff. It's like scraping a scab. You keep scraping it open. And now it's really sore. It's a patch of skin that you can't even touch because you react. And that's what's happening. I'm going to tell you a little bit, I think, about the dynamic, the etiology, if you will, of how you got to this point, okay?
Okay.
Maybe that can help you. And hopefully it will also help you, quote unquote, toughen up. But in fact, I don't think you need to toughen up. I don't.
Hmm.
I think you need to think up. And I'll tell you what I mean by that.
Well, that's me. I'm going to tell you what I mean by that now. Sometimes we get cut off by the break, and Andrew says, you didn't really say anything of value after the break, so see if you can do a little better this time around. One of the things that's happening, there's actually two levels I would point out. One is there is a component of, how can this person do this to me? There's this component of self-protection. I don't deserve that. I don't do that to them. Why would they say that to me? That's mean. I don't like that. So there's this component of, you shouldn't treat me this way. But once you get to the point where you say, well, it doesn't matter what they shouldn't, they did. That's the reality. That helps. But here's the second one. She made the allusion to her boss as repetitively doing this. This is not something that every so often her boss maybe gets a little bug and says something. No, this is a style. A good way to look at this is when you know the way someone is, they should lose power to make you feel bad. It shouldn't get worse. You shouldn't say, it's building up. I'm getting worse and worse and worse in reacting to them. No, it should go the other way. Once you know what they're like, their style, this is what they do, they should lose impact.
and this is true with anybody, if you know they're surly or if you know they like to put down or criticize, after a while, don't you become kind of numb to it? Sort of the way it is. So it's a reverse effect. Most of us get more upset the more it happens. We should get less upset the more it happens. Does that sound realistic? It is. I'm Dr. Ray. Thanks so much for joining me here. Andrew, thank you for all the editing you do on that end there at Ave Maria Ann Arbor. Appreciate all of you listening to me. Appreciate you keeping me company. Walk with God. He doesn't criticize you. He loves you lots.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.